As I warned you last session, we have to kind of bounce around between different passages in the Kings and the Chronicles in order to get the good chronological flow of the story of Israel during its divided kingdom period. So what we've got so far is that the northern kingdom, which is the most populous and has the most region to it, is being governed by Jeroboam. And he has established an alternate faith to the faith in Judah, which is the southern kingdom. Now, he believes that he is promoting the worship of He Who Is, but he's doing it by golden calves. But he's also engaging in other worship of other gods and goddesses as well. So, big problem there, and we're going to come back to something that God has to say about him, about that issue in just a moment. The southern kingdom of Judah is where the capital city has been, it is where the temple is located, and it is where the throne of the descendants of David has been established. But they, too, have fallen into the sin of worshiping other gods and goddesses, and have suffered because of that. Sheshach, the pharaoh of Egypt, actually invaded their territory in the fifth year of Rehoboam's reign and took an awful lot of the gold and silver and precious things out of the temple and out of the palaces and took the hundreds of gold shields that Solomon had made and put in the house of the forest of Lebanon. So they've had a big ding against them as well, and they seem to have repented a little bit. And so things have calmed down a little bit in the south, but they are not really calming down up in the north. So let's pick up our story today in 1 Kings chapter number 14, starting at verse number 1, where it talks about an event that happens probably later in the reign of Jeroboam. And it says, at that time, Abiya, the son of Jeroboam, fell sick. So this seems to be a child of minority age. Just how young he is not altogether clear from the passage, although I think it hints at the idea that he's fairly young. Verse number 2. Jeroboam said to his wife, "Arise, disguise yourself, that it not be known that you are the wife of Jeroboam, and go to Shiloh. Behold, Ahiya, the prophet, is there, who said to me that I should be king over this people." So Jeroboam is going to send his wife on a secret mission to inquire of God from a true prophet of God that is still living inside the boundaries of the northern kingdom of Israel. Now, he lives at Shiloh. That's actually where Jeroboam first ran into him. Because when Jeroboam was functioning as the head of impressed laborers for King Solomon, this prophet met him and tore up his own new cloak and gave 10 pieces to Jeroboam and said, "God is going to give you 10 of the tribes whenever Solomon's kingdom is split after his death." And at that time, Jeroboam was told by Ahijah that you will have an everlasting dynasty if you will just live by God's standards, if you will just adhere to the covenant. Well, he's not done that. But he's the only true prophet that Jeroboam feels he can reach out and get a good answer from regarding the health of his ailing son. So he tells his wife, verse 3, "Take with you 10 loaves, some cakes," these would be cakes of bread, "and a jar of honey, and go to him." So this is the gift that you're going to give to the prophet in order to get information through him from God. He will tell you what shall happen to the child. Jeroboam's wife did so. She arose and went to Shiloh. Would have taken her probably most of a day's travel to get there from where she's at Tirzah, which we'll find out later seems to be the new capital city being used by Jeroboam. She arose, she went to Shiloh. Remember, Shiloh is where the tabernacle once stood back in the time of early Israel, right before Samuel. So came to the house of Ahijah. Now Ahijah could not see, for his eyes were dim because of his age. So some time has passed since the last time we met this prophet, and he has now lost his eyesight, or at least most of it. Verse 5, he who is said to Ahijah, behold, the wife of Jeroboam is coming to inquire of you concerning her son, for he is sick. Thus and thus shall you say to her. So God gives the prophet a heads up and a message to be passed on. Continuing, when she came, she pretended to be another woman. So she's just coming in pretending that she's a woman with an ailing child. She wants to know what the future holds for him and what the prophet can tell her. And maybe even to petition the prophet to ask God for the healing of this child. Verse 6, but when Ahijah heard the sound of her feet as she came in at the door, he said, come in, wife of Jeroboam. Why do you pretend to be another? So he is not fooled because God told him who it was that was showing up at his door. Then he says, I am charged with unbearable news for you. So right there he tells her, I've only got bad news. Verse 7, go, tell Jeroboam. And what we really want to pay attention to here is the message to Jeroboam that he has failed to keep the covenant as God charged him to do. If he had kept the covenant, if his people had continued to worship at Jerusalem but live underneath Jeroboam's leadership in northern Israel, according to the laws of God, everything would have been fine. But he didn't do it that way. He instead came up with this plan about the two golden calves, one at Bethel and the other at Dan, and allowed the worship of other gods and goddesses. So he has totally abandoned what God charged him with when he made him king. Verse 7, go, tell Jeroboam, thus says he who is the God of Israel, because I exalted you from among the people and made you leader over my people Israel, and tore the kingdom away from the house of David and gave it to you. That's a reference to the whole symbol that was used by Ahijah the prophet when he ripped his clothes up and had Jeroboam take 10 of the ripped up pieces. So I tore the kingdom away from the house of David, gave it to you, and yet you have not been like my servant David, who kept my commandments and followed me with all his heart, doing only that which is right in my eyes. Now, of course, there's a caveat here, and we see it in other places, and it should be assumed whenever we see phrasing like this, that David was not given a pass by God regarding his sinful activities, such as his adultery with Bathsheba and his cover-up of that adultery. God was not pleased with that, but here's the story. David did repent, and David did get back to doing things God's way. So he resolved his relationship with God after that sin. Jeroboam is not falling into that category. He has gone away from God and does not have any intention of coming back. So verse 9, but you have done evil above all who were before you. And that includes Solomon, who ended his life as a tyrant and an idolater of the first order. So you have done evil above all those who were before you and have gone and made for yourself other gods and metal images, that'd be the two calves that he's talking about, provoking me to anger and have cast me behind your back. So you have thrown me away. You've tossed me behind you and you're moving the opposite direction. And so here comes the penalty. Verse 10, therefore, behold, I will bring harm upon the house of Jeroboam and will cut off from Jeroboam every male, both bond and free in Israel, and will burn up the house of Jeroboam as a man burns up dung until it's all gone. So just as in some places they actually burned dried out cow manure as a heat source, as a fuel source, and when you do that, it all burns up. And so he says to Jeroboam, I am going to take your dynasty down. I had told you that I would perpetuate it if you would just live by the covenant. But since you won't live by the covenant, I am going to terminate your dynasty. Verse 11, here comes a prediction about how the people will die in the process of this dynasty dying out. Anyone belonging to Jeroboam who dies in the city, the dogs shall eat. Now, these are the feral dogs, scavenger dogs, and they would roam around eating garbage and eating anything that had been just left there that was edible. So basically, the prediction is any of Jeroboam's family members who die from here on out inside the city limits, people are not going to bother to bury the bodies. They're just going to let the scavenger dogs chew them up and treat them like garbage. And anyone who dies in the open country, that is outside the city limits, the birds of the heavens shall eat, for he who is has spoken. So no burials from here on out with one exception. Verse 12, arise therefore, go to your house. When your feet enter the city, the child shall die. So this is mom that's being told this. The child who is sick is not going to survive your return. Verse 13, all Israel, that is northern Israel, shall mourn for him and bury him. For he only of Jeroboam shall come to the grave. Because in him there is found something pleasing to he who is the God of Israel in the house of Jeroboam. So that's one of the reasons I think he is a younger child. He's innocent in that sense that he's not done anything sinful or shameful at this point in his life. And even though he's now sick and is going to die, he alone will escape the curse that God has put on this dynasty. He will actually have a good funeral, and people will be sorry to see him go. Not so much for dad, mom, his brothers, all of those that follow. They will be despised in such a way that nobody will even want to touch their dead bodies and bury them. Verse 14, moreover, he who is will raise up for himself a king over Israel who shall cut off the house of Jeroboam today. Now, this is kind of ironic because God used Jeroboam to put pressure on Solomon because Solomon became a tyrannical king, a bad king. And now God says that he's going to raise up or allow to rise up another person in the northern kingdom of Israel that will do the same thing against the Jeroboam dynasty. Verse 14 continues into 15. And henceforth, he who is will strike off the house of Jeroboam today. He who is will strike Israel as a reed is shaken in the water, and root up Israel out of this good land that he gave to their fathers and scatter them beyond the Euphrates. Now, this jumps way ahead. We're actually kind of looking at a time period right around the 920s BC, something in that neighborhood. The entire nation of northern Israel will be taken into Assyrian exile right around 723 BC. So they're only going to get a couple of centuries at the most before judgment falls upon this nation. And they will go into exile just as God said would be the case for those that abandoned the covenant. And they will. It'll be a shocking thing to see them rooted out of the land in this fashion. But here's the reason why it's going to happen. Because they have made their Asherim, remember Asherah was the female deity of the Canaanites. She was the counterpart to Baal, the thunder and lightning god. So she was the goddess of heaven. She was the fertility goddess, the love goddess. She was usually symbolized in her worship by a tree of some sort, either a living tree that they worshipped under, or perhaps a carved out tree, like maybe a totem pole sort of thing. And that's what they'd gone to already. Think about this. We are only a few decades after the zenith of the Solomonic kingdom, when the temple of God was built, and everybody from all over Israel came three times a year to the temple to worship He who is God, the Creator God of Israel. But the fact of the matter is, underneath that veneer of worship, there was already the beginnings of rebellion. And so once Solomon gives in to the desire to worship other gods and goddesses, everybody else that has that desire, they start doing it as well. And when Jeroboam and northern Israel get established, and even though they try to have some sort of nod toward He who is the God of Israel by the making of these golden calves, even in that, they violate God's law, and they also add into their worship of those golden calves, the worship of other gods and goddesses, including Asherah and Baal, I'm sure. And so it says here that the reason they're going to go into Assyrian exile is because of their Asherim and how they provoked He who is to anger, that is to wrath. Verse 16, and He will give Israel up because of the sins of Jeroboam, which he sinned and made Israel to sin. So Jeroboam, the first king of northern Israel, planted the seeds of rebellion and apostasy that will finally bring about the exile of the northern region of Israel in 723 BC. So she got her message, and she makes her way back to the palace from which she came. Verse 17, then Jeroboam's wife arose and departed and came to Tirzah, and I'm sure she cried all the way home. And as she came to the threshold of the house, the child died, exactly as the prophet had said. And all Israel buried him and mourned for him, according to the word of He who is, which he spoke by his servant Ahijah the prophet. So he was the only good thing of this first reign of northern Israel. And now he is gone. And there's only a little bit of time left for the dynasty of Jeroboam. At this point, we need to go back to the kingdom of Judah and talk about them some more. And that means we just kind of scroll down a little bit to verse number 29 in 1 Kings 14 and pick up the story of Rehoboam's death and the coronation and the early reign of his son, Abiya, or in this text, it's Abiyam with an M on the end, that had been functioning as the crown prince and had been working in preparation to become the new king of Israel, or excuse me, of Judah, southern Judah, whenever his father died. Now, this is all going to happen in the 17th year of Rehoboam's reign, which means that he would have been right around 58 years of age, because he was 41 when he came to power, and 17 years of reign, that brings us to 58 years of age. Okay, verse number 29 of 1 Kings 14. Now the rest of the acts of Rehoboam and all that he did, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Judah? And you've got something similar over in 2 Chronicles 12, 15. Let me read it to you. We'll be right back in 1 Kings in a moment. Now the acts of Rehoboam from first to last, are they not written in the Chronicles of Shemaiah, the prophet? So that's one of the guys that's been dealing with Rehoboam on behalf of God, and of Edo the seer, which is another man that has been dealing with the kingdom of southern Judah. And so they're probably authors that contributed to the 1 Kings passage. And then the chronicles that are mentioned in 1 Kings are probably the chronicles that we have in our Bibles. Now, the rest of 2 Chronicles 12, 15 says, there were continual wars between Rehoboam and Jeroboam. So there was fighting along the border, debates about where exactly that border was supposed to be, the entire time that these two men ruled as contemporary kings. Now back to, let's see, I think I want to go back to 1 Kings 14, 31. Rehoboam slept with his fathers and was buried with his fathers in the city of David. His mother's name was Naamah the Ammonite, and Abiyam, his son, reigned in his place. And as already mentioned, Abiyam is the way it's spelled here in the Kings. It's Abiya over in the Chronicles. And I think the Abiya is the probably closer to his original name, because that last name component is the shortened form for the divine name of God. His whole name would have meant, my father is Yah. So, the Creator God, He who is my father. And so that seems to have indicated at least some of the mindset of the family of David, Solomon, Rehoboam back at the beginning of this guy's life. Chapter 15 of 1 Kings says, now in the 18th year of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, Abiyam began to reign over Judah. And we're going to see this this comparison between the kingdoms on a regular basis, and it helps us in establishing our chronology. So I believe we're talking about the year 924 BC. Verse 2, a little bit of a summary. He reigned for 3 years in Jerusalem. So he does not stay alive very long after he comes to power. So he is going to die a very young man. I mean, if his father is about 58 when he dies, then, you know, knock 20 years off of that. And that gives you some sense of the upward age possibility for this man being in his 30s. And yet he only lives 3 years beyond his ascension. His mother's name was Maakah, the daughter of Abishalom. That's Absalom. His mom was a relative of his dad. And we've talked about this before, that royal families seem to feel that they can control things a little bit better if they marry within the family. Now, what's he like? Verse 3. He walked in all the sins that his fathers did before him, and his heart was not wholly true to he who is his God as the heart of David, his father. So he was not the best of people. He was a wicked man himself, down in his heart. Verse 4, nevertheless, for David's sake, he who is his God gave him a lamp in Jerusalem, setting up his son after him and establishing Jerusalem. So he is allowed to stay on the throne for a few years, just long enough for his son to come to power, because his son is the better man. Verse 5, because David did what was right in the eyes of he who is, and did not turn aside from anything that he commanded him all the days of his life, except the matter of Uriah the Hittite. And we talked about that before, that that's always the caveat. Verse number 6, now there was war between Rehoboam and Jeroboam all the days of his life. And we'd seen that already once, and here it's a reminder that that war was inherited by Abiah. And Abiah is going to, tomorrow when we come back, invade the northern kingdom of Israel. Because in his mind, that's his territory. That's part of his birthright, to be king over all the tribes of Israel. And he feels that he actually has a divine calling to force the northern tribes to come back under his throne. Now, he's wrong in a larger sense, but he is going to gain a little bit of territory because that's the way God wants it to be at this time in history.